When I was in high school, I took a law and justice class. I can't remember why or what would have possessed me to do such a thing. Perhaps I had heard a rumor that it was easy. I don't know. But I ended up in this law and justice class. And I don't remember very much about it, except that one day, the teacher came in, and he presented arguments against the practice of capital punishment. And his primary argument against it was that studies were indicating that it is not a deterrent to crime. In other words, it's not accomplishing what it should be accomplishing. And so as an outmoded, outdated, and now useless bit of antiquity, it ought to be done away with. I don't think I was a Christian at the time. I would have said that I was, but I don't think that I was. But I did come from a Christian background, and at the very least a conservative American background. My family was always supportive of capital punishment. And I remember on that day bringing a common sense argument to meet the objections of my teacher. My common sense argument was along these lines. It would deter me. I don't know about you, but being a person myself, I know that such punishments are a deterrent and would be a deterrent for me should such a temptation arise. Interestingly enough, years later, I would discover that the whole argument was entirely misguided. Frequently, in these sorts of disputations, we find ourselves talking about the wrong things altogether, don't we? So years later, I would be reading, on the point at hand, really. Jonathan Edwards was talking about what strengthens and weakens motives in the hearts of men. And he pointed out that all things being equal, you would rather have your pleasure now than later. So present objects of the will tend to be stronger. Those that are more remote in time tend to be weaker. One of the great examples of this is we want to lose weight, but the actual accomplishment of that is remote in time. But the pleasure of the chocolate cake is here right now. It's one of the difficulties in summoning the motivation for this sort of thing. And right away, I understood why the American practice of capital punishment isn't working very well. If you commit one of these crimes, you don't know when, if ever, that sentence will be executed against you. It's so far in the future as not to seem very real. But that's still not the point in this whole thing. The whole argument was misguided because the primary purpose of the punishment of sin is the glory of God and His justice. And you might say that that will stand irrespective of the welfare of men, whether it seem like good government, that is, it's deterring other crimes, or whether it be useful for reclaiming offenders and so on. I know we think about these things and we talk about these things when we talk about the punishment of crimes. I'm not saying that's altogether illegitimate, but what I am saying is it's not the primary purpose of the punishment of sin. The glory of God's justice is the primary purpose. And so we were talking about the wrong thing altogether, and now, as I come to an adult man, none of this is really surprising because we are all hopelessly self-absorbed, aren't we? We forget about God, His claims, His glory so easily, so readily, and we just get to talking about ourselves and other people and what's good for us or what we think is good for us and what works for us or what deters us from crimes or what's useful for reclaiming us. Us, us, me, we, us, us. And we forget about God altogether. Punishment and the purpose of punishment is the manifestation of the glory of God's justice. That is not easy for us, but it is necessary for us to understand. And this is not to deny those other purposes. God's manifold working and wisdom will frequently not only glorify his justice in a particular action, but by his wisdom, he will also bring good for his subjects, the glory of his goodness, and bring them into sort of a perfect harmony by his wisdom, the glory of his wisdom. So there will be a certain richness of his attributes displayed in a particular action. But we need to remember that the first thing is always God's glory. That is always the first thing. And I do think, as we come again to our incest legislation in Leviticus chapter 18, turn there with me, that we see these dynamics very much at work. And we enter into one of the principal heads of the controversy, which is it's always the practicality. So if these incestuous marriages are disallowed and dissolved, and the parties involved executed, what's to become of other people that may or may not have been involved? Their children, their parents, their friends, what happens to society, and so on. And so all of these practical arguments are heaped up to try to show why God's legislation is really a bad idea, and that we've figured out a better way to do these things. So these issues are very much part of our text in front of us and the issues that pertain to it. Remember, in Leviticus chapter 18, this is part of what exegetes call the holiness code. It begins at chapter 17 and it runs to the end of the book. What does it mean to be holy, separated unto the Lord our God? We need to be holy in our marriages. That's at least a part, a portion, a facet. Leviticus chapter 18. So in the beginning of the chapter, we are told that rather than obeying or imitating the heathen around us, we're to obey our God. He has a claim upon us. So he says, I don't care what the Canaanites are doing, the land to which you're going. I don't care what the Egyptians did, the land from which you came. You are going to obey me concerning these things. Now look with me at verse 6. This is the prohibition. This summarizes everything up to verse 17 and one sentence. None of you shall approach to any that is near of kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. So here we have a prohibition of the conjugal act and thus the conjugal relation with respect to any near relative. From verse 7 to 17, all that Moses is doing under the inspiration of the Spirit is defining for us what a near relative is. So how near is too near? And then what, how remote do we have to be in order for it to be pleasing to God? So beginning at verse 7, and if you look there at your little chart, which I've copied for you again, you see yourself in the upper left corner there as person. Good to be so esteemed as person, right? Verse 7 prohibits, and just try to remember the work that we did. It's a consanguinity or a blood relation prohibition. Your parents and your children are forbidden to you. That's the first degree in the direct line. These are lineal blood relations. And then in verse 8, those same relations are forbidden yet with respect to affinity. That is, relationships that are entered into with respect to marriage. So parents and children, whether by blood or by marriage, are prohibited. And the censures could not have been higher. If you remember, we looked at the text in the church. It was excommunication, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 also tells us this is not just an Old Testament thing, not just Old Testament legislation, but binding upon God's people and all people, really, and unto all ages. In the state, the censure was capital. The people involved in these relationships and marriages were to be executed. All of that is frightening and terrible, but not as terrible as the last point, as we looked at it last Lord's Day. The Lord assures both his people and the nations that are subject to his rule, that would be all of them, that if they did not discipline these things, he would. His curse would rest upon the offenders and the churches and nations that had failed to discipline these things. So this matter could not be more serious. And given the fact that our nation, together with all of the nations of the West, have relaxed these laws and continue to do so, in other words, relax them more and more, this is enough to make anyone tremble. You remember Ezekiel chapter 22. This was among the reasons that God cut Israel off from being a nation, a body politic. They had refused to discipline and punish these incestuous marriages. So we pick up with verse 9. If you look at your text with me. The nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or the daughter of thy mother, whether she be born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. So we have already treated the lineal relationships in the first degree, parents and children. This is the first in what is known as the collateral line. That would be the line of your siblings. So I know that they bent the line, but your parents also belong over you. If you look at your little chart, that bent line could have gone straight up. They've bent it for the sake of the neatness of this graph. But you notice that your brothers and sisters form the beginning of that collateral line, that line that runs next to your own proper line, which would include your nieces and nephews, grandnieces and nephews, great-grandnieces and nephews, and so on. That would be the collateral line. Here we have the prohibition to uncover a sister's nakedness, whether that sister be a full sister, if you look at the first clause, the nakedness of thy sister, or a half-sister, whether by father or by mother, the daughter of thy father or the daughter of thy mother. So a half-sister would be, I don't have this case, but if you imagine if my mother had died and my father had then married another woman, and then they had a child together, that would be my half-brother or sister, whatever that child was. The language of half means they share half my blood, not my same father and mother, but just my same father or my same mother. But here, it's very clear that it doesn't matter if it's your full-blooded sister or your half-blooded sister, just your sister, however you might interpret it, and they are forbidden to you. Then, interestingly enough, this is further specified, whether she be born at home or born abroad. Another way that this could be rendered would be something like a relation at home or a relation abroad. The idea is, so whether that sister grew up with you in your same household, or whether that sister grew up in a different household, that doesn't change the case. She is still your sister. Because you could see the problem. Well, what if she grew up in another family? Or some sort of thing like that. Does that relieve this obligation? Moses, under the inspiration of the Spirit, says that's irrelevant. She is still your sister. So here, by way of prohibited degrees, and all of this is expressly stated, a man may not marry his sister or his half-sister, and it doesn't matter where she is. And of course, by parity of reasoning, a woman may not marry her brother or her half-brother. So if you're marking these things off your chart, you'll see parents and children have already been marked out. Brothers and sisters are also marked out there. And by way of punishment, this is also expressly mentioned as being a capital offense. If you flip forward to Leviticus chapter 20, where the punishments are described, Leviticus 20, verse 17. And if a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, it is a wicked thing. They shall be cut off in the sight of their people. He hath uncovered his sister's nakedness. He shall bear his iniquity. I want you to notice here, something is specified that we didn't have specified before, but the cutting off, which speaks of capital punishment, is to be public. Cut off in the sight of their people. We'll come back to this at the end by way of application, but there was a very important reason for this, a reason for my introduction and why I introduced the sermon the way that I did. It was so that Israel, seeing the end of this, might fear and the evil be removed from them. In other words, I don't want that to happen to me. I'm not going down that road. So they would see, they would hear, they would fear, and they would do no more wickedly. But we'll come back to that. And interestingly enough, these marriages were not just capital among the Hebrews, but they were capital among the Romans as well. So this was something that was understood not just by the people of God, but something that nature taught. And once again, the curse of God would rest upon such and become manifest, if not disciplined, by earthly authority. Deuteronomy 27, cursed be he that lieth with his sister, the daughter of his father, or the daughter of his mother, and all the people shall say, Amen. We are coming to the place in the history of the Western nations where nations formerly Christian will no longer say Amen to these things. They deny that the curse of God rests. And if you remember, we read last Lord's Day, the PCUSA Constitution is written in the 1950s. They said that these things were approved by God. Not the consanguinity relationships, but marriages contracted within the grounds of affinity would be recognized by the church as pleasing to God. Refusing expressly their amen in great rebellion against God. What has happened to us that these things are even possible? Verse 10. The nakedness of thy son's daughter or thy daughter's daughter, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover, for theirs is thine own nakedness. So once again, this is a relationship of consanguinity. There's a prohibition here of a man may not marry his granddaughters, whether they be the daughters of his son or the daughters of his daughters. And then the reason that's given for this is that it's the uncovering of one's own nakedness. Very interesting. Something I want you to think about. Great many interpreters take this as implying that all of the lineal relationships, no matter how far, are forbidden under this reason. I do think that the law of nature, as expressed by all nations, has generally very much disapproved of any sort of intermarriages along the line of descent. And there are other things that would start to make it unseemly. So if, you know, grandchildren are prohibited, if a man were to marry his great-granddaughter, you've also got the unseemliness of the disparity in age and all of these other things. But wouldn't that just as much be the uncovering of his own nakedness as the granddaughter? In other words, the reasoning that is given here applies to more things than just this specific case. But I'll leave that for you to think about. At least expressly, a man is forbidden here to marry his grandchildren. So also grandchildren would be forbidden to marry their grandparents. And there might be a prohibition. I'll let you think about the reasoning, but of all of the lineal relationships, they cannot intermarry. And finally, verse 11, the nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, begotten of thy father, she is thy sister. Thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. Okay. At first glance, you look at that, and if you've been paying attention, or if your head's not swimming from counting all of the degrees, that's why a chart's very helpful in working on something like this. You'll probably look at it at first glance and think it says the same thing as verse 9, right? Half-sisters have already been forbidden. So my father's wife's daughter begotten of my father would just be my half-sister, and this would be a repetition. Some interpreters have thought that it is just a repetition, but repeated because this was one of the more common mistakes when these sorts of incestuous relationships were contracted, the marriage of a half-sister. I would be among those that think this to be very unlikely. Some interpreters have said, all in all, this legislation is very, very brief. Much to be done in very few words. Redundancy is not to be expected. In other words, if you're going to try to say a lot in a few words, you wouldn't want to be simply repeating yourself. I do think that there's another possibility here that's more likely, and I think comes to the surface when you work a little bit on that word begotten and some of its other personal possible meanings. I think that the idea here is not a half-sister, but a stepsister, the daughter of your stepmother by another marriage. But then the problem is, well, what about the begotten of your father? So here you are. You've got a single father. Your father marries a woman. She already has a daughter, and so you're no blood relation to that daughter at all. But you've now come into a certain sort of relationship because of the marriage of your parents. But that language of begotten of your father, moledet in Hebrew, it comes from yalad, which means to beget, which is why this is the common translation. But it can also mean something as general as kindred. So here the text would read something like this and give you a different sense and meaning. It would say, the nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, because she's the kindred of your father. And because the kindred of your father, she is a sister and prohibited to you. You see the relationship there? So I do think, and I'm making this easy. We could do a whole hour just on the various interpretations that have been given to this passage. I'm giving you the one that I think to be the most likely, the strongest, and it's the strongest because in some ways it's the simplest. So by affinity, the marriage of your parents, she enters into the relationship of sister with you. And so here you would have the prohibition of a man marrying his stepsister or a woman marrying her stepbrother. So interestingly enough, you put 9 and 11 together, it doesn't matter if she's your full sister, your half-sister, or your stepsister, she is off-limits. She is out of bounds. So let's leave off our exposition there and try to take away something useful for ourselves. First of all, remember that the primary purpose in all punishment is the glory of God's justice. And it might be uncomfortable for us, such as we are, but the God of infinite wisdom and perfect justice teaches us what is just in this case and what he would have to be done. In your outline there, you should see Westminster Confession of Faith 19:4. To them also, and that would be Israel, to them, the Israelites also, as a body politic, God gave sundry judicial laws, which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now further than the general equity thereof may require. And you say, Pastor, why are you reading this to us now? Let me give you a little bit of my own personal history with Confession of Faith 19:4. So my first experience with this was through the thoroughly Americanized Presbyterians, and they wanted Confession of Faith 19:4 to read something like this. So to the Israelites, God gave judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now, full stop. So they just simply ignore the whole business about equity. And that's the way that they would want it read. This was my experience in the PCA, certainly, and in a good portion of my experience with the OPC. The judicial laws of Israel, together with the ceremonial laws, are simply put into the past. And unhappily for the judicial laws, are perceived as being even less valuable than the ceremonial laws, which can teach you things about the gospel. Okay. Later on, I found myself among those that call themselves theonomists. Variegated, complicated movement. I don't intend to long comment upon the theonomists, but I think that they would want to read it in this way. To them also, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws, obliging all others. Period. That's the way they would want to read it. It was only later among the establishmentarians or the historic Presbyterians that I was given a fuller sense of what the divines intended here. They did say that the law, the judicial law, had expired with the state of Israel. They had been given laws peculiar to themselves because of their particular historical circumstances, like one of the famous examples is the fencing of their roofs. They tended to build houses with flat roofs. The roofs were treated as like another room, except you could fall off. So God's law required that the roof be fenced so that you or your neighbor didn't unwittingly tumble off. Okay? We don't spend time on our roofs. So they'd say this law, in its particular historical manifestation, is past. We really don't do that sort of thing. But they go on to say that the laws, the judicial laws, do teach us abiding principles of fairness and justice, which are really just part of the moral law, for fairness, justice, equity. And inasmuch as it reveals those things are obliging upon all people all the time. So, for example, when bring all this together in cases of capital punishment, when a certain crime is committed and God says they are to be punished with death, that is equitable or just. He's teaching us what equity is. We might say, well, we don't have to throw stones at them anymore. The particular way that that was carried out in its circumstances, I'm not pleading for that. But it is equitable that that crime be punished with death. And no human legislative body ought to say, that's not fair, or that's not equitable. We're being taught by God's law what is fair, and what is equitable in these particular situations. Now, why did I say all of that? Because authorities, whether they be civil, ecclesiastical, or even parental in the home, ought to be concerned first and foremost with the right representation of God's mind concerning the offenses that are taking place and manifesting his justice in these things. That's our first duty. That's our first job. Whether or not this is good for everyone is always a secondary concern. I'll tell you something that happened with one of the recent disciplinary cases. Some of you will have been privy to some of these things. But, of course, there was much discussion about whether or not the discipline was good for the young people, or whether or not some other approach might have been better for them. Of course, I wasn't happy that all they could think about still was just themselves, because there are other people and their well-being involved. But all of that remains irrelevant until the first and primary question is answered, which is, what would God have us to do about this? How is his justice to be manifest in the world of men? Because our first duty is to God, and to glorify God, and to clear him from this wickedness. In other words, as church officers, our job is to make manifest his frowning countenance. And so people can, you know, talk about, would this be a little bit better for them, a little better for them, whatever. Until that question is first asked and answered, none of that amounts to a hill of beans. God's claim is first. And compared to that, all of the kingdoms of the earth are as dust. It doesn't matter. I had another situation. This one in counseling, in a situation that didn't have anything to do with us. A husband and wife split without legitimate biblical grounds, splitting from one another. And so then the man who was against the split comes and he sits down on my pastoral couch. What do we do about this? And he had all sorts of personal things that he wanted to talk about. You can probably guess that this was our last meeting together. I told him, I said, I know that you have all sorts of felt needs, and I'm sorry. But the primary need here is that God and his glory be vindicated from this evil, because this is taking place in a church that's professing the Christian religion. So you've got felt needs, I'm sorry, but that's not what I want to talk about today. What we need to talk about today is moving the church to discipline so that Christ's name will be cleared from this wickedness. Every other human consideration in this now does not matter. It has been so subordinated as to have receded completely into the shadows. Once Christ's glory and justice has been vindicated, then we'll start pulling those things back up and working on those things. He found me completely impossible to understand on this point. Do you understand me? I hope that you do. Two reasons. This is the chief end for which you have been made. That's a pretty important thing for everything. And second, as far as the time that you spend with me as pastor and so on, you'll find it impossible to understand me if you don't understand that. God's glory must be cleared. Christ is never to be seen as an author or approver of our sins. And when those sins become scandalous, when they stink not only in the body of Christ but begin to spill outside of it, our primary duty is to Christ and to clear him with respect to these things. And declare, not just as a session but as a people, he is no author and no approver of this wickedness. So once we all understand that, then we can start working on what's best for the parties involved and so on. So that's a hard lesson and a hard thing. But let me see if I can now fill it with some of the sweetness that belongs to it. If that had been the end of the story, who could ever look at God and say anything other than, even so, for it seems good in thy sight that it be so? But God has so arranged things according to his goodness and his mercy and an infinite wisdom that those things that are most glorifying to him have always been designed for the best of his people. In other words, those things do tend to be the very best things for us in almost all situations. And so here's just a couple of illustrations of God's condescension. And if I can return to the question in the introduction. Interestingly enough, capital punishment, if it is done right, is a deterrent, as are all punishments. The problem with the United States government is they're not doing it right, not even close. Here are some of the things. So in other words, when these things are done, good government is in view. God's not only glorifying himself, his justice, but he's also glorifying his goodness. He's governing his people well. and according to sound principles. I'm going to read to you a little phrase. This is in the case of idolatry, but if you know the law of God, you'll know that this is frequently repeated in capital cases. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he hath sought to thrust thee away from the Lord thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. And all Israel shall hear and fear and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. So if you had any sort of a false teacher or idolater that was trying to lead you away from God, it was a capital offense. And what does infinite wisdom say? But that if you do this properly, people will see, they will hear, they will fear, and they will do no more such wickedness in your midst. I cite this as just one example of many. The constant refrain in capital punishments, that this evil might be put away from among you. That this evil might be put away from among you. So how is it that the government is failing? Solomon the Wise tells us, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Ecclesiastes 8:11. There was never a governor in the history of the world like Solomon, and he's laid the finger on where the breakdown is. If you tell a person that if they commit one of these heinous crimes, that they might get caught, and if they get caught, they might be executed some 20 or 30 years down the road when they're very old, no, it's not an effective deterrent. But if you were to tell them and practice and say, here's the deal, you commit one of these crimes, you will be arraigned immediately, you'll be tried immediately, and if you're found and convicted upon just and clear grounds, you will be executed immediately, publicly. Now that would be quite a deterrent for people not only to avoid these crimes, but to stay far away from them. You don't want to get tangled up in any of these things where that sort of eye of justice might be turned toward you. So there is good government very much in view. And a final thing to bring it even nearer to home concerning the welfare of men and why God has designed this incest legislation the way that he has. The welfare of man, of course, is very much tied up in the welfare of families. And I'll tell you an obvious thing, painfully obvious. What is going to happen to the family if sexual interest is allowed to intrude into these relationships, into the innocency and sanctity of family relations? Because we all know in the history of the world, not just nuclear families, but grandparents and aunts and uncles and all sorts of relationships that have been entered into by affinity, all of these things were frequently around families, and frequently these were all dwelling together. So you'd frequently, you might say to a man, it's not appropriate for you to be living alone in your house with that woman who's not related to you, right? But if that exact same woman is your sister, then everybody thinks it's fine. And they should. And it should be fine. Because the Lord has endeavored to make sure that sexual interest, he's programmed us this way by nature, a sense in which conscience resonates and witnesses against this sort of thing, but also expressly by his law, he has set a bounds for that sort of interest so that this happy, comfortable, helpful, mutually edifying dwelling together can be possible. And it wouldn't be possible if this sort of interest was allowed to intrude. What would happen to the relationship between, say, a woman and her children if any one of those daughters, as they enter into maturity, could become a rival for her husband's affection? You'd find all of the daughters being, time for you to go, nice knowing you, out you go. Or a mother-in-law. Or a grandchild brought into the house. If these could be rivals for the affections of the couple, it would be nothing other than the destruction of all these relations and the impossibility of them dwelling together. in that happy, harmonious, safe, edifying, helpful way. So we see in all of this that our God is wiser than men. As it's described in the scriptures, his folly is wiser than the wisdom of men, because he is able to glorify his justice, but also be good and do good for the children of men, all by the same actions and activities. Let us give praise to our God in prayer. Please rise.